Jacobs, or Bolins and Jacobs, or Jacobs and Bolins.
Irish biscuits.
Irish biscuits, yes. I mean, it was so big. I mean, it did imply an awful lot of people, and it gave...
Well, that's right. There were nearly 2,000 at one stage.
Yeah.
There isn't even a biscuit made in this country now under the Jacob brand.
And
which you probably heard before.
Yes, but it we're all reminded of what it was through the a lot of the advertising material would tell you that, and it was known all over the world.
I mean, yes, it was a household name, absolutely. And China exported to Hong Kong and China at Christmas time. There was tins of export. It's a famous story. They put a certain coloured ribbon on a Chinese order. They couldn't realise why it didn't sell. And the colour, I think it was yellow or something, was a symbol of mourning, i.e. like putting everything in black here. You know, black is a symbol of mourning. But this particular colour, the ribbon that they put on the tins without knowing it, was a symbol of death or mourning or something. And there was a... They all had to be taken off or cut off or something. That's one of the legends.
Yes.
I look record. All right. This one. It's just my uncle on the Fitzgibbon side. He got an MC in Italy in the Royal Artillery. And I remember I was fascinated by this, you see. And my father was a little bit resentful that they were in the armed for services and he was only a backroom boy. And I think that got to him a bit. He wasn't a serving officer.
Yeah.
But I remember asking Uncle Gibby one night, what did you get the MC for, you see? I mean, I put a couple of strong whiskies into him, and I thought I'd get it out of him this way, you see. And he said, for slopping around in the mud in Italy. And that was all he would say. Yeah. You don't get MCs for slopping around in mud.
So was your father similar in many ways? That... Your father must have had a very strong character he shared the management of the company, but was he one of these, as you say, if he was in the army, he would have been disciplined and he would have got that discipline of...
Well, he would have been in the Navy. We wouldn't go into the army.
Army, yeah. Well, was he strong?
The Navy was his thing.
Yeah. Was he strong upper-lipped?
Well, very much so, yes. Yeah, he would... He wouldn't show his emotions much.
He was always that way.
Yeah, always. His mother was very, fairly hard woman on them. And if you got into trouble with her, you were in real deep trouble. So that would obviously have a controlling effect on your expressions, I think.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you?
Well, it would rub off.
Yeah,
yes,
that's what
course,
I mean, yeah.
And so your father...
And his father, I don't remember his father very well, Sir Walter, but... there was simply a bit of tension there, whether he was a very strict man or what, I don't know. He was a Welshman, but I don't know. I remember he was such a total contrast to my other grandfather that I lived with, who was what you saw, you got what you saw, and you saw what you got.
This was the Fitzgibbon.
Yeah, they were quite very forthright people. You know, there's a story about his brother who was a QC, or KC, and he just coming back from the law library service in St. Michael's, you see. And one of the law library juniors said, there's Frank Fitzgibbon, KC, coming back from church, and I'm sure God listened to him.
But like you said, you know, he was highly decorated, yeah.
He got orders of Légion d'honneur, and he got a Russian decoration as well.
So he must have...
He achieved an awful lot, as a civil servant, yes. He said, you can look him up in Who's Who if you want.
Yeah.
Got a cutting of it somewhere.
But, and again, did your father live into old age, or what age was he when he passed away?
He died in... 1991, and he was born in 1914, so he was, what, 75, 74?
Yeah.
Not a great age.
No,
he got a cancer of the throat, I think.
Yeah.
As a, esophagus cancer. I think that's what got him in the end. I don't know. Hmm. He kept it very quiet. He didn't want anybody to know, including the family, for a long time.
And that would have been similar with the business as well.
Probably, yes.
Not discussing it with you.
We used to discuss it a bit, but not in any depth. But I didn't want to be sort of... I moved out of home when I joined the firm first, got a bedsitter, because I didn't want to live at home. There's Daddy's little boy going home telling tales about what we get up to or what we don't do in the factory. And I wasn't going to do that.
Of course, yeah. No, your independence was...
Needed to absolutely. Be there. Yeah. To be seen to be there as well.
Of course.
Just after Dad died, Danone bought it.
Danone bought it?
Yes, because when he died, the shares were 75 pence or something, or a pound. And Danone bought it for a fiver, which was great, because it set Mother up for the rest of her life, because she had the family shares left. Dad would have been spinning in his grave... If he'd had one, he was cremated at that.
But
the French people then, according to Jonathan Bewley, Jeremy, they never invested another penny in the place. They just ran it into the ground.
That's right.
And I think that upset, I know it upset Jonathan much, to quite a degree. Mm. And I think it upset various other people. Whether Leo O'Donnell, as you've seen later today, he might have a view on that, which would be much more revealing.
Right.
And he would be a much better person to bring that sort of thing up with. The end game, if you like.
Yeah.
He would be more familiar with it than I would. I used to go to the odd shareholder meeting before the takeover.
Yeah.
But that was more to just annoy them all. And get a free biscuit or a free drink out of them.
I see. But your father didn't live long enough to witness that.
He didn't witness that other part.
And that was a good thing.
Well, I think so, yes. That would have really broken his heart.
Yeah, of course it would.
It would have broken his heart, actually.
Yeah. And maybe... But your mother was secure and set up, as you say.
Well, that's right, yeah. Which was good. And then she moved to England. Because 6 months after Dad died, my wife had a stroke.
Oh, I see, yes.
And I looked after her for 14 years. She died about 5 years ago.
You came out unscathed from the whole thing. Because
well, apart from working there for 10 years, that was a scathing enough experience at times.
Yeah, but interesting enough that looking back in those years, do you feel that, was it part of your life that you actually... could say that you would repeat it again or you would do things differently?
Well, as I said before, I would have liked to turn it the other way around. Come in as an experienced businessman without people knowing what experience I've had, rather than being fresh out of Trinity College.
Yeah. I understand.
That's the point, the whole point that I made in the first place.
Yes, yes.
Because I think everyone would have a much more... because at the times they were bringing in consultants and things to tell them how to run the place. I don't know. You know the definition of a consultant. You can tell everybody else how to do it. You can't do it himself.
Hmm. So how long did you stay with the company that you worked with afterwards?
10 years.
And what did you do then?
Well, I found my own agency of an anti-glare screen, which was made in Ireland for an American company. And I sold it successfully for 20 years. And I used to go around to the customer and say, these things are made in Ireland. I don't expect you to buy them now, but I do expect you to try them today.
Right.
Buy an Irish hat, you see. Never dies, as far as I'm concerned.
Would you feel very strongly about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Things must be made in this country and have added value done to it. I mean, I was always keen to have beef processed here, not exported on the hoof to be finished. Add the value here, bone, like the Argentinians do, bone it and wrap it and package it and sell it for the highest value you can get for it.
But explain, what was it that you were producing then, or that you were...
The anti-glare screen.
Yes.
It was a mesh that was made conductive. And you put it directly onto the computer screen when they were green and black. It would sharpen up the image and would also take all the static off it. And also damp down any radiation that people were worried about. But that was more theoretical than practical, I think. But
yeah.
You'd put one up in front of one of the girls and say, what do you think of that? And she'd say, that makes a huge difference. So I'd give it to them for a week and, as a trial.
Yeah.
Get a signature for it. Then follow up. And then usually you'd get about a 75% take-up.
Where was your markers?
The banks. Anybody had IBM equipment. IBM machinery. The banks, insurance companies, anybody who had a computer, basically.
Yeah.
So I got 20 years out of that till the product died a death because the technology all changed. So that's that in a nutshell, really.
Oh, no, that's fantastic. But you were there in the beginning.
Yeah, I got very good support from one of the directors. He trained me very well.
Who was he?
A fellow called Eric Hogarth and then another fellow called Dieter Grabus. They were both Californians with European,
yeah,
with strong European connections, so they knew what they were doing.
Yeah,
unlike some Americans.
The other, you know, we're talking about the businesses in Ireland, the your own business, the businesses you were involved in. Williams's, were you? What was your connection with?
Well, no, I sold to them when I was selling the filter screens. But Tullamore, they're extraordinary people. You go down there and they'll buy it practically on the spot and pay you on the spot. Unlike a lot of other parts of the world where they'll hum and haw and buy it perhaps and then you have to go through all the stages to get paid, you know, from invoice to statement to this sort of thing. But I thought that somebody said because Tullamore is a pocket of ex-Cromwellians or something and so they have a different mindset to things. Whether that's true or not, I don't.
And the other big business names in those days, the Findlaters.
Back in the, well, that's pre-Superquin and Quinsworth and Williams.
Yeah.
But Findlaters virtually went down the tube.
So your father, Geoffrey, in his lifetime, did he receive any awards?
Well, he was made Freeman of the City of Waterford in honour of his Jacob connections, because Jacobs originally made ship's biscuits in Waterford before they moved to Dublin.
And that's where they started, is it? Yeah. So you're... And what year was that?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It doesn't say, unfortunately.
But that was a nice...
And they also they had his portrait was painted by Phelan. Gordon Lambert, being interested in art, enabled that. Because Gordon Lambert was a very famous art collector, as you probably knew.
Yes.
So that was about it. I think Dad was quite proud of the fact that he was made a Freeman of the City of Waterford. He certainly talked about it. It's a lot of pleasure. That's all I remember that he got.
But then...
He was also chairman of Packaging Institute, I think, and also chairman of the FUE. I'm not sure.
Hmm. You have a picture here of Bishop Street.
I'm not sure of the date.
Yeah, it was a five story corner building.
Yeah,
and
the far side of it is the Adelaide Hospital.
Yes,
and there's the graveyard in the middle, which they moved all the contents of the graveyard out to Mount Jerome. And it was turned into a break area, smoking break area, because there was no smoking anywhere in the factory, except in the canteen. Smoking wasn't even allowed in the boardroom.
Oh, they were way ahead of their time, you weren't see, they?
It was only in the canteens or out in the snack bar out in the converted graveyard at the back of the bakehouse.
I see, yeah.
Which was great, because we didn't smoke at the desk.
When you say converted graveyard, what do you mean?
Well, there was a little graveyard, Huguenot graveyard, encompassed by the sort of almost an enclave, and they moved everything out to Mount Jerome.
Yeah.
Nicholas Undertakers did it.
Exhuming all of the remains, yes, bringing them out.
Yeah.
See.
And that grave is now, it's a mass grave out, or a big grave in Mount Jerome.
Did they own the property beside the large factory?
Part of it, I think. It was the tin wash. This is that bridge thing.
Oh, it bridges.
The bridge over Bishop Street.
Yes.
And the far end of that now is the National Archive.
Yeah.
But this is all converted, rebuilt, and it's into the DIT, isn't it?
That's part of DIT.
Yeah, that's right. And then there was the church, St. Peter's, was there next to the Church of Ireland Church. And after Kennedy was assassinated, we decided to have the factory would have a special, there was a Memorial Day for Kennedy, I think, in Dublin. Mm. So we arranged that there'd be two church services, one in Whitefriars Street for the Roman Catholics, and the Church of Ireland, non-Roman Catholics, all went to St. Peter's Church of Ireland Church. And I vividly remember, it's the only time I was in it, I vividly remember over the chancel was the wording, "The God of Jacob is our refuge." And I found that rather ironic that we were all Jacob's people sitting there.
Well, it was an extraordinary story.
Thought that would amuse you now.
Well, the story is incredible, and thank you so much indeed. And so you were baptized Dennis, but you are
Dennis St. Michael. I was baptized in the Rotunda Hospital,
because
of my Fitzgibbon grandfather connection. And I was the St. Michael, of course, comes from St. Michael's, G&J's.
Oh, of course.
House.
Yes.
So Dad slipped it in, I think, the saint bit. Because his father was also, he was baptised Walter St. David Jenkins. So there's a tradition to pop a saint in before, when you're baptised, which is quite extraordinary coming from an Anglican Quaker tradition, perhaps.
But
anomalies of religion.
But you lived through your life being called
Michael.
Michael Jenkins, thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.